My name is Mira Eskelinen. I'm a queer performer, writer, and producer based in Helsinki and interested in all things hybrid and trans.
So can you go, how did you become the artist and writer and producer that you are today?
It all started in youth theatre. I got into theatre when I was like 12 or something, and I absolutely fell in love with the performing and with the people, and also like all the stuff happening backstage. Like I've always been also in super interested in, like, you know, how the sausage gets made and like how it happens, and like all the like light design and set design and how it all gets pulled together. So that was the early onset. and then I stayed on that track for a long while. Like that was like, I think in my youth, like the most consistent thing was that I went to theater practice every week for like 8 or 9 years, and I was almost never like, I never skipped the practice unless I was like sick. And then yeah, at some point, like when I got older, like, or like then I went into like a performing arts high school, because that felt like the natural choice of like wanting to pursue this and wanting to keep playing with people, pretty much wanting to keep like making these connections with other people. And then also at some point I realized, like, oh, because I was also interested in what happens like behind the scenes and how the plays were made, and how, well, at some point I got interested in how films got made. Then I tended to be also the person who organized things. And because not that many people want to organize things, a lot of people want to just like do the thing. But then, like, I was also a person who was good at organizing things, and I didn't mind organizing things. And that, a lot of times I also enjoyed organizing things, so I ended up also like doing a lot of production work, even though like before even I would have called it production work, it was just the things that needed to get done and somebody had to do them, and so I did.
So it was more like you really just wanted to get, like, sometimes there's like you know, the bossy girl who's like wants everything done a certain way, but it sounds like, did you just like learn all these things because somebody had to do them?
Yeah, it was a mixture of that, of like somebody having to do them, and then getting this classic thing of getting praised for doing those things and being like good at them, and then seeing like the end results as well. Because what I also really enjoyed, and what I've like enjoyed for a long time, is bringing people together and bringing like introducing people to each other and seeing what like comes out of that when different artists or different friends or different friend groups meet, and then like what blossoms from that. I guess that was also a part of it, that I was just very intrigued to see how things happen. Like, I've always like been more interested in sort of what the question of what happens when these people or these art forms or these audiences and performers come together than the end results itself that much. Like, I have ideas of like how it could look, and I can see like a version of a thing that what could happen, but then like I'm more interested in, like, especially these days, in building a almost like a playground, mm-hmm, like for people to come in.
Yeah, like, yeah, a situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What about, so when you were younger, did you have an idea like, I want to go into this, or I want to do this specific thing? Like, did you want to be acting, or did you want to be directing, or were you kind of all over the place like you still are now?
I think back then I really wanted to be acting. That was the main thing. That was also the sort of when you're in like a performing arts high school where everybody wants to be an actor, like that is the sort of, that is what you see being wanted, and that is the sort of career path you see, and those are the things that you also like practice in the school much more than like directing or screenwriting or script writing or like, of course, also those, but then the sort of actors got put on this pedestal and actors get to be on stage, and being on stage is so exhilarating and fun. So I really, really wanted to do that. And I think I applied like maybe once to the theater academy and didn't get in. And I think it was also more of like this dream that so many people share that I also like wanted that, even though then I've found, I mean, I love performing and I love being on stage, but I've also found so many other things that I enjoy in like creative fields.
What about like thinking about, because as a young actor, and like if you're a young actor who is aware or not aware of their gender identity being a complicated thing, do you reflect on that thinking? Did that affect you at any point, like in acting? Or were you using it in any way, or was it just like not even on the radar at that point?
I think it was there. I remember like doing some plays and performances, and maybe it's part of just like learning your craft as an actor, but like I was doing all of this like, oh, I'm just kind of this outside in kind of a thing that I was, which I think many young actors or people who want to be actors do, like they have this sort of aesthetic image in their head of what it looks like or means to be like acting. And then I was like more focused on that of like, how would I look on stage? And I didn't want to dig that deep like into my own emotions. And I remember specifically, this was already a bit later, maybe like 23, 24, around that time, I hadn't been like doing that much acting. I was more focused on like producing and films at that point. But me and a couple of friends were doing the, the Dumb Waiter?
Oh yeah,
by Harold Pinter. Yeah, and then I was supposed to play the younger male character in that, and I was just like, I was having this acting crisis of like, am I just this shitty of an actor because I cannot connect to this young male energy of this character, and like I was having so much trouble, and I was just like, oh no, I'm just such a shitty actor. And then it was like, no, there was this huge disconnect within myself and my gender identity that like kept like creeping in there in between, I think.
Yeah. I also went through acting school and wasn't that conscious it was there, but I wasn't that conscious of the gender identity thing, and I kept getting cast as male roles and kept going like, why do I keep getting cast as male roles? Because like I feel like am I that shitty an actor that I can't do this like these feminine roles properly? But you know, all these directors were looking at this opportunity that they saw, and I just took it as a failure on my part. Yeah.
I just need to practice my craft even harder.
Yes. I have to come here and do voice lessons at 7 in the morning and free my impulses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when did drag come into this?
Drag, well, originally drag came into my life when I was very, very young because my godfather is a drag queen.
Okay.
So, and...
So this explains everything.
Yeah, it does. In a way, it does, because my godfather was a very important figure for me when I was a kid. Like, I, like, adored his playful attitude towards life, towards, like, towards gender, but also, like, to creativity in general, because he bubbled with creativity and stories. So, sort of, just the idea of drag, of playing around with gender performance, has existed in my life, like, ever since I was a kid. But then, and of course in theater, it was always like this, like, there were so few boys, so then the boys would always, like, be put on, like, there would always be this moment of, oh, let's dress up the boys in, like, dresses and makeup and all of that kind of thing, which I always gravitated towards, surprisingly. But then, like, drag as it is now, or like as Miss Vinyl Envy, that came into my life in 2015. RuPaul's Drag Race was starting to, like, beginning to get traction. My girlfriend at the time was watching it all of the time. And I remember, because I was in the middle of my film producing studies, and I was so, like, I would look down on all reality shows so much. And then, I got hooked to Drag Race as well. And then friends of ours hosted a Halloween party with this like gender bend theme, and I went full in on that for also, like, other reasons than just being interested in drag. But that was so much fun. And then a friend of mine, who was also a producer, was producing a performing arts night, and she had seen some of the pictures of me from Halloween dressed as a woman. And then she asked me that, hey, like, do you want to do a performance? Like, have you been thinking about doing drag? And you can get 15 minutes and come
15.
And do 15. Yeah, it was ridiculous. but then Unni Leinonen, we were dating at the time, we started doing drag together. Like, she would do my costumes, she's a costume designer and set designer, and I would then, like, practice the performance and do all the like lip sync and the mixing of the tracks. And in the beginning, I wasn't even doing my own makeup because I didn't know how to do that yet, so I had friends do that. And I think the first performance was kind of, I treated it as a test, because I hadn't been doing, like, performance for quite a while at that point. I'd been trying different things. I had been doing, like, music, I had been doing rap, I had been, like, the Harold Pinter thing, all sorts of things that kind of, like, I had fun with them, but something was amiss. But then with drag, it felt like I could, like, bring all these things together that I really enjoyed. And I remember joking about it, that I don't have to be good, really good at any of those things, but if I just bring all of them together, it will become this unique mix of, like, performing and acting and dancing and storytelling. and whatnot. And but yeah, it was so much fun. And like, because neither me or Unni knew what we were doing in that sense, because that was the first drag show that either of us had done. So yeah, then we did like 15 minutes with like three completely different looks.
Which 15 minutes is a long, for a beginner, that's a long set.
Yeah, it is a long set. And it was like, I remember because there were like, I think like minute long outfit changes where nothing happened on that stage. And we just like shuffled backstage and like did like this. And like, it was like head to toe different looks.
Oh no.
And then I remember the last bit was like, I did my own rap in drag, because like rap has also been like something that I've always loved, and then like I wanted to like incorporate some of that, of like doing my own like songs in drag. But then I hadn't tried out the song in 15 centimeters stilettos and a corset. So I couldn't, like, I lost my breath like halfway through, and then I just like kind of wheezed through that performance. And it was like, I remember feeling so ashamed of that, but still the whole thing was like, it ended up being so much like on the like good side, or like it was so much fun. And of course, like, the whole gender thing was underneath that I was like, I was so exhilarated of being able to explore that side of myself, even without naming it as transness at a point. So then I decided that, okay, this test was a success, and now I'm gonna like see what comes out of it and like start pursuing that. Also because I just had so much fun, and me and Unni were so well together, like our creative brains really like
a symbiosis.
Symbiosis, yeah. And this sort of like back and forth of like one of us brings a creative idea to the table, and then the other one takes that and runs with it and like kind of lifts it, and then the other one comes back and lifts it even higher.
Positive feedback. Loop.
So it was also a lot of fun.
Was it odd to be kind of, I mean, you were also doing other things in other scenes, but was it strange at that point to be in the drag community, like not as a homosexual male?
Yeah, it was. And I felt like at times I was like, oh, I hope I'm not like sort of intruding, or like I tried to be sort of mindful of that. And I think there was like an idea of queerness like within me that I felt like, oh, like I'm not a gay guy, but there's something queer in me that comes out like while I'm doing this. But it was like this weird conversation that I was also having inside my head of like, how like can I, and because I felt like I couldn't not do it because, well, also because of, as a performance art, I think it's a fantastic art form, but also because of like all the gender feels that gave me. And it was like, it gave me a good excuse to also like explore and try those things and try how it feels to like move around in the world being seen as a woman, and like, or like how all of that like gave me feedback on how that might feel, or like all these like different things of like gender euphoria that I maybe wouldn't have named as gender euphoria back then. But it was so strong that I was like, okay, I can't stop doing this. I really, really want to see what's here. But then being mindful of this. Yeah.
But at that point, I think as well, like one of the biggest drag shows, or to me, certainly the most important drag shows in Finland at that time, was Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
Run by Lola Vanilla and Lamy Krackhouse. And I remember seeing their show and their what at the time I would have called bio drag, which we don't say anymore, but a cis woman doing drag, and me being very confused as to how does this fit into drag, because it's about gay men. But was it, you know, what was it like to, because Lola and Lamy were, and always are, extremely inclusive and basically really good at going against sort of what might be on RuPaul's Drag Race level of the community, and they're doing their own thing and saying like, this is actually who we want to see doing drag, and we want to see this, and everybody kind of doing their own thing. But were you like, do you think, help that you were around them specifically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like I remember the first Drag Me to Hell show I went to was, I think, in February 2016 with Ben de la Creme headlining. But I remember Rat Queen from that show. I remember Lola Vanilla doing this amazing Material Girl piece where like she's just twirling this piece of gum in her like mouth and like feeding that to audience members, and like I remember looking at that and I was like, okay, this is like, I want to be part of this community, because it seems like it's so free, and there was something like inviting to me that, or like, I think I recognized something in them as well, even though I didn't like have the name of that for myself yet. And I remember, because I was dressed up in like full drag galore for that show, and I remember like after the show Lola Vanilla came up to me and asked me like, who are you?
Yeah.
And do you do drag?
Yeah.
And then I said like, I just started, and she just said like, oh, I have my eyes on you. And it took me, then after that, it took a year for like me to like do my first Drag Me to Hell show, because Lola wanted to see me perform, and I didn't have a lot of public performances, and then finally she saw me perform at like a friend's birthday party where she and I and some other performers were all like invited to perform. And after that, like, she and Lamy booked me for a Valentine's Day show, or a Valentine's Day show. But yeah, that community and this feeling of inclusion, and I think also partly because Betty Blackheart was doing a lot of stuff at that point, and there was already like some like overlap between like the burlesque, underground burlesque and underground drag scenes, with like Betty and Lainey and Lola doing shows. But also there were a bunch of sort of seemingly straight couples doing drag or burlesque, and but having this some queerness to them and to the art form, so that it wasn't like I was a complete anomaly in that.
That's nice. So again, you were kind of like able to see like that it's not necessarily a big focus on one particular way of doing things that interests you, but the cross-pollination between things that have, you know, that they meet and then they twist each other around a little bit and...
Yeah.
And play.
Yeah, I've always loved hybrids, and hybrids bring a lot of joy to me.
So if I ask you about a rundown sort of the current projects that you have.
Currently, well, there's obviously Punch Up, Resistance and Glitter that you and I run with Juuso Kekkonen, which is then like, well, we've now run it for 5 years, and then next year will be the last. So that has been a huge, huge thing. that has been a huge thing. Then I'm working on my first book at the moment. Actually, not even first. I've done a photography book, which I always forget. But that was
you done a photographic book?
Yeah.
Okay.
About, like, I did it with Lilja Tamminen in 2011 or 12, about sort of like socially outcast youth, or like, how do you, like, syrjäytyneet? Nuoret, how would you translate that?
I always think of like the from Dan Savage's podcast, the at-risk youth.
Yeah.
You know, the tech-savvy at-risk youth. Yeah, they had.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I'm working on like a first full-length, book, which should come out.
Fiction or non-fiction?
It's once again a hybrid, mixing auto-fiction and essay and fiction. And it's coming out in the spring.
Amazing. What's it about?
It's about, in a nutshell, it's about how being trans has made my life better. And the things that being trans and being openly trans has brought into my life. And then it's also a lot about, well, the sort of trans narratives and the pull of certain trans narratives and what other trans narratives we could have or imagine.
So you mean certain trans norms or according to cisgender people or according to transgender people?
Both a little bit, but especially like from a point of view of a trans woman, or like, I mean, I guess any trans people in general, like, because the narratives we have are quite limited. And for me, for example, like, I don't see a lot of old trans people, or like, how, like, what's the sort of, because the best trans, even the best sort of trans stories end up with this sort of, oh, well, now that person has happily transitioned, living basically as stealth, and then...
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean the older stories, yeah.
Yeah, and then this sort of like, what happens then?
Mm-hmm.
What's the rest of your life? What does that look like? So I'm very interested in that.
Exploring. That is quite interesting. Even it'd be nice to write about those, you know, without outing the person.
Yeah.
Who is like, I'm sure there are many people who are older who are living as stealth and like would tell their story, except that it defeats the purpose of being stealth.
Yeah.
You know, so it would be nice to tell their stories without outing them.
Yeah. And I totally understand like why people would want to be stealth. But yeah, sort of.
But in terms of like artistic work as well, it also means that we miss out on openly trans artwork. Whenever there's somebody who is stealth,
yeah,
and older in that sense, which again, it's not our it's not our business to say like, oh, you have to come out so we can categorize your art as trans art.
Yeah.
What else about like? Do you also like talk about like the narratives of you're a young person and then you suffer a great deal and then you contemplate suicide and then you dress up once and then you transition and like that kind of narrative?
Yeah, that is also a big question of these sort of misery narratives that we have, because also for myself, well, the classic sort of that you have to have a life full of misery. The other thing is that you should have always known these things that also like, it took me a while to admit to myself that I was trans because I didn't fit those very limited narratives that I felt like I wasn't trans enough, or I was trans in the wrong way because these things like didn't didn't fit my life story. And also like I'm also very interested in the question of like what it means to like build a communal narrative around suffering, because then within like the trans, within trans communities, there is so much joy and creativity and love, and it doesn't mean that it should be either or, but then this focus on just the suffering part, and especially like when demanding rights and talking about rights, that it's always like now that the new trans law is being discussed, like, well, obviously the anti-trans voices and that those arguments, like we all know like how those work, but even like within the government, the people who are for trans rights, they also always, they only talk about the hardships and the suffering that trans people face as the reason why trans people's like human rights should be respected. And I just miss talk of and discussion about all the other things that transness can bring and can be.
Why do you think they focus on the negative?
Well, I think it's a classic. It's a very, in a way, efficient way of trying to get sympathy and trying to get people to see your side and why, like, a certain group of humans should have rights. But it also carries the risk of, well, not necessarily like infantilizing this group of people, but robbing this group of people of their agency. Mm-hmm. If they are just these sad, suffering people who then, and like trans people are sad and suffering, and then the cis people come and, you know, save them and make things better by, you know, giving trans people basic human rights.
Yeah, I think maybe too that you know, if you have this like these poor suffering people who must be helped narrative is much easier than saying, actually, let's give gender rights to everyone, because then the cis people have to be prepared to argue for their own gender freedom.
Yeah.
And they would rather not do that. They would rather say, look at this poor suffering person that I can help, rather than say, actually, I could also benefit from having a more open society. Yeah. I feel like that's like a hard sell for them to, you know, admit to themselves as well.
Yeah, because this whole focus on the suffering also, it doesn't challenge the notion that being trans is somehow worse than being cis. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, like you said, that it's like it helps the cis people not to question their own way of looking at gender, their own way of, yeah, seeing things and constructing things. That it's just easier to be like, oh, but we help these these poor, poor, poor suffering people.
And it's a health question too. Yeah. That it. Let's the conversation stay that trans people are people who need mental health help rather than trans is also healthy.
Yeah. And then this question of also like bodily autonomy comes into play, that then like if the only thing that we focus on or that is focused on is the suffering, then that also like is reflected in the diagnostic processes, that getting like trans-related care always needs to stem from a place of like proven suffering, that it's not something that could increase happiness or well-being, even though that is like always like kind of like it might be mentioned that, oh well, this like brings down, you know, getting a proper trans healthcare brings down like numbers in like suicide attempts or depression. But then what if we twisted that and said that, oh, like getting or turned it around and said that, oh, getting translated care actually makes people like happier, lead better lives. And maybe it's something that cis people are missing out on.
Yeah. Why did you choose to have a book?
The opportunity presented itself to me, and it's been a dream of mine for a long time, and I've always loved the written word. I've always loved stories and how, like, especially like how in literature, how you can tell stories through that medium and how intimate it feels as a reader sometimes. And then when the pandemic started, then when I couldn't perform and produce almost anything, then I started writing more. And then luckily I was also I got commissioned to write essays to like by queer editors who had heard a podcast or an interview. And then I found such happiness in, not happiness, but like, well, happiness, yeah, and content, this feeling of like deep content in writing and in the process of writing. Because I've always been very restless as a person. And that's why I've also been like jumping to and fro from like between a ton of different art forms. But yeah, in writing, I found this. Silly to say, I found peace in writing, because sometimes I fucking hate writing. But yeah, there's something grounding and calming in the craft itself that then was very lovely, and then I wanted to pursue that.
But you also, I think you follow quite a bit of literature by other transgender writers.
Yeah.
What do you like? What is kind of spoken to you a lot?
I think for me, the thing I love about trans literature is, because when cis people do and create art about transness, it always sort of transness gets sort of stuck in these very classic narratives and narrative structures of like, oh, you once you are A, then dun-dun-dun-dun-dun happens, and now you are B. And like the beats are always the same in a way. And then in trans literature and in trans art, I think in general, but what like really speaks to me in trans literature is also like taking the form and seeing like what, like if we apply transness or gender nonconformity or like the multiplicity of gender, not just into the story, but into the form, what does that do? What does that do, and how does that feel? And sort of like, how does trans time look when it all, when the author lets it affect also the structure of the piece. And that has been so fascinating to me.
That's super interesting. That's like a really like performative writing in the sense of actually doing something with the text, with text itself, in that. Who's been doing that kind of work?
Grace Lavery's Please Miss was a fantastic example of that, of mixing also different genres, of mixing fiction, completely like like having fun with that also. Because I think that also ties into this, like what we talked about, like how cisgender people generally view trans people, or view gender, is not through play. But then, like, as so many trans people I know view gender through the lens of play and having fun with that, and then how that gets reflected in literature. Yeah, Grace Lavery's Please Miss.
I've heard that. I still haven't read Detransition Baby, but that's another one on the
Tori Peters. Yeah, that is a like a very a wickedly funny, not so very dark, but very,
I very really,
poignant. Kai Cheng Thom's Notorious Liars and Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars is a fantastic example of also of a unreliable narrator, because trans people get always framed as unreliable, but then like she takes that and then like is an unreliable narrator in her own trans story.
That's
and,
great.
And there's lots of like fantasy elements added to the whole thing, so you're not sure what's happening and what's an imagination, but it is a fantastic little book.
There's another one I was thinking of that I also haven't read yet. Mm-hmm. I haven't read anything because I'm reading PhD stuff all the time, but Gretchen, someone who wrote this horror novel, and it's like a totally gory body horror about like something along the lines of there, it's like a zombie apocalypse, but like, and like something along the lines of like, there's estrogen in cis men's, testicles. And so trans women are like roaming around and basically making eunuchs out of cis men to get the testicles so they can produce the estrogen that they need, kind of thing. And it's this wild sort of, and of course, a lot of people were reacting to it as like, don't demonize trans women in your book. And Gretchen is like, no, I'm going to write body horror all I like. And I love that as well. Like, I think, you know, that literature, I think it gives, probably gives trans writers or, and trans readers, like a little bit more room to just imagine things without taking a hit for it.
Yeah.
Even though they will as well.
Yeah, because I'm, for example, thinking about this short story that was published
the
a few
attack
years ago.
Helicopter the helicopter. Yeah, it was really unfortunate.
Yeah, that whole like story with Isabel Fall is, yeah, it's so sad. But then that story in itself, like, it's so fascinating. And this, like, what I love, yeah, about trans literature is this, like, reaching towards, like, something and playing around with it and taking an idea of, like, oh, attack helicopter, like the most tired anti-trans joke there is. And then actually looking at that, then just imagining, like, what would a world be? What would a story be where this is actually taken as face value and someone sexually identifies as an attack helicopter?
Yeah.
And it's it can be found, like, from the depths of the internet, that short story. And I mean, it's not a perfect short story by any mean, but it's, I love this grasping towards of like what would it mean if we looked at gender or sexuality through this lens, and then the whole backlash was so horrible.
And the backlash came coming from the trans community, saying that you this is harmful to our community, this is damaging. And then Isabel stopped writing, but also, if I remember, detransitioned.
Yeah, I said that, because she was, forcibly outed.
Yeah.
Because people were saying that, this writer, I remember some, cis woman reviewer saying that, this person who wrote this, it's so clear that... they are not a woman. Yeah. And these horrible things. And then then there's this interview with Isabel where Isabel says that, okay, that because the feedback was so, and the backlash was so strong and so harsh and so hard that she decided that, okay, that she cannot do this, that she will not, she clearly, she felt that she clearly cannot, because if people are looking at her texts and saying, oh, this person cannot, writing this cannot in any way be a woman, then for a person that can be devastating.
Yeah. And she was trying to play around with an idea that is, the people who were also doing the backlash comes because of the precarity and the vulnerability of the trans community, and feeling that creativity is, I don't know if you ever feel that expression is, tricky, or that, if there are ideas that you think, oh, I would like to play with that idea and be playful with that idea, but I don't trust that it won't come back to me as I shouldn't play with this because it touches on something that people are too vulnerable about.
Yeah, there are some concerns and thoughts in my head about now, for example, writing the book, because I write very, very openly about my sex life, for example. And then I don't know how that will go down.
pun intended.
And I feel like it's very important also for me to write about that, because there's so little written. Of course, there's a ton of stuff written about trans women having sex, but a lot of that is not written by trans women. So there's a difference. But yeah, and it's because I follow a lot of the, especially conversations concerning trans literature, abroad and especially in the States. And yeah, sometimes it's the discourse wears me down precisely because there's this idea that, you cannot touch certain subjects, or you cannot explore difficult topics and subjects in your art precisely because, that could harm the community at large. It's sort of I know we've talked about this before, how to talk or how to make art as if the TERFs are not listening.
But often, as well, the TERFs are actually not listening, but other trans people are listening, worried that the TERFs are listening.
Yeah.
Which is understandable completely.
Yeah. But then again, it's also with the TERFs, no matter what you say or what you write or what you do art about, they will have a field day with it nevertheless. So,
well, it's free publicity, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I think we have to talk about Punch Up and similar projects that you've done. I don't know what you want to say about what is Punch Up?
Punch Up is a queer variety show that brings together drag, burlesque, stand-up, and sometimes other art forms. That I think it is, in a nutshell. And for me, what's always been the most fun thing about the show has been bringing together different art forms, different performers, different audiences. Because, I mean, we curate every night, like we invite different performers every night. So then it always keeps it keeps changing and evolving and mixing.
Because we were chatting earlier about like the burlesque and drag scenes having a little bit of an overlap back in like 2015, 2016, but I think it was we would be backstage and notice that like, hey, these people could probably perform together and would like to know each other's work, but they are in different, they're kind of siloed in different genres.
Yeah.
And nobody in stand-up knew anybody in drag, but there were, you know, there was queer stand-up bubbling under and all that, so... a way of kind of bringing that all together. And we didn't really know if it was going to work.
Yeah, it was... Because basically just Madhouse Helsinki, because we all had... Yumi and Juuso had worked with Madhouse previously for a bunch of different projects. You started Feminist Comedy Night there. Then we did some solo shows with Juuso. And then we did You Can't Be Serious... a 7-night thing, the three of us, which was the first thing that we three worked together. And and then Madhouse Helsinki gave us 2 nights and we were like, so what would be fun for us? And yeah, it was this sort of feeling of this, oh, something is bubbling under. And because we were kind of moving within all these art forms. And I think especially also like there was some overlap, yeah, between drag and burlesque. But yeah, like you say, stand-up was like its own separate silo. And I think there was also like all these preconceived notions like from both sides of like what those art forms are like or what that art form is like. And then seeing the queer performers sort of bubble underneath and also performers who wanted to also explore and combine things. And then also, like, the audiences were very sort of separate. So then we thought, that, oh, let's see what happens if we bring the performers together. Let's see if the audience also comes together and what happens. And, yeah, the first night it was at Tiivistämö. Yeah, it just clicked. Pretty much immediately, like there was like this idea of like, oh, we have something here, like something about this works, and not just in this way of bringing people together, but the feeling in that room of being like, people have described it in many different ways throughout the years, but I remember the photographer Sade Puusa, who was present at the first night, and then she wrote about it later that it was this magical feeling of community, like between the performers and the audience members, and that it felt like so warm and loving.
Do you think do you feel like we set out to create community?
That's a good question. I think, again, like, I don't know about you or yours, but I think I was personally most interested in, again, the question of what happens if we bring these performers, these art forms, these audiences under the same roof. Like, I think we all had this idea, like, oh, there might be something here, because we all shared this, oh, like, this sounds like fun. And, like, I think we all had an inkling of, like, that this could work. But then, it turned out, like, that it really worked.
And maybe you can tell a little bit about how, where Punch Up went from there.
What I think is the most, like, it's the amazing thing about Punch Up is that we've managed to recreate, I don't know if it's recreate, but to enable that feeling of community, of temporary community, night after night after night. That is just amazing to me. That it wasn't just like this once or twice, but that it has happened pretty much every time we've performed. And we've done like around 50 shows by now.
Yeah, I don't think we've had a bad night.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had nights that were more or less Shazam, pizzazz, blow your mind, but
yeah.
I don't think we've had a bad show.
Yeah, and yeah, it's wild to think. But then, yeah, from that, then it evolved. Like, we did a couple of shows at Madhouse. After that, we had already been working with Culture Factory Korjaamo. We had done Feminist Comedy Night there, and then we suggested Punch Up to them, and we were there for a couple of years before the pandemic hit and closed everything down.
How did it change when it went to Korjaamo?
When it went to Korjaamo, the production value went up, or in this sort of the environment, in a way that it was still very much of the underground queer art that we brought there, but then suddenly we had like way more lights and like this way more sort of polished setting and this lame curtain that we all were so excited about. But I remember all of us having this moment of like, oh shit, what do we do now? Because the setting suddenly like lifted.
Yeah, we're not in a dirty bar right now.
Yeah, and like, and that also has been wonderful to see, you know, like how lots of pieces and performers have also evolved or been able to like try out new things, because a lot of the shows have happened at this like very intimate venues, but also like with very little tech or very cramped backstages, or like, well, we're like in these like underground venues. But then what happens when that gets brought up on bigger stages? And I remember like when in like, for example, your discussion with Eleanor, where you talked about how when you haven't had a big stage, you might not know what to do with a big stage, and this how like queer art is sort of seen or valued.
Yeah, like getting a big stage also can be a big ego boost for a performer in a really good way.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, and it like it feels like, oh, I am being seen in a different way. That it's not just this thing that needs to be tucked away in a corner. You know, like, I love those, like, shows at dingy bars. They have, like, this, like, such a special quality to them. But then I think it's also like, again, creating these possibilities and futures that all like our art is also, the art that we do can also be presented on a bigger stage, and it can sort of retain its queerness and retain its radicality and radicalness.
Sure. Either one.
Yeah. Either one. Yeah. But have this sort of, you know, institutional or technical support that helps it like shine and develop and evolve even more.
Speaking of institutions, we should tell the story about how Punch Up made it to the National Theatre main stage.
Yeah. Well, it started with the National Theatre doing a play all about my mother, and then casting a cis man to play the trans feminine character, and then the artist Camille Auer then spoke publicly about this, and then there was a big discussion about it, and which like ended up, well, the National Theatre went back and forth with the casting decision, and well, ended up not doing anything about it. But then there was a lot of discussion about trans representation in theatres in Finland, and then there was a National Theatre together with the trans organisation Trans RU hosted a panel discussion about trans representation in theatre, and me and Camille and activist B. Antonin were all there. And then after that discussion, I remember Mika Myllyaho, the head honcho of the National Theatre, the main director, I guess is the title, I don't know. But anyway, Mika Myllyaho said that, he's always open for suggestions for pieces. And you, me and Juuso had already talked about the possibility of offering Punch Up onto to National Theatre, because, we hadn't done any shows at Korjaamo since the pandemic started, but even before the pandemic, we had already been touring a bit, and we had received funding from Kone Foundation to do a tour around Finland that, this last spring we finally got to do. But we were confident enough in the show that we thought that, this could fit on the National Theatre. We suggested the Vallila stage that was just about to be opened. And we sent, like, we had all the materials of, we had the tech writer, we had the brochure, like a, you know, like an actual show, an actual theatre piece would have. And then, like, even though when we contacted the National Theatre, we said that, well, we don't expect this to be, like, we don't expect you to book us because of the conversation, but because this is a show that is worthy, or like that can do well on your stages, or that, like, that. And of course, there was the opportunity for them to then to also mend some of the damage done. And then they suggested that, would you want to come and do a show on the main stage? And that is, of course, an offer you can't really refuse. And then we did. And it was historic. And it was full. And it was...
it was loud.
It was loud. It was a magical night. And it was like 2 days before the show, like the last COVID restrictions of that autumn got lifted, so we could sell the whole place full. We did. And people were ecstatic, not just because of the show, but because where the show was being held, and like this, just this signal that we also belong on those stages, on the most prestigious stage of the country, because it is called, it's not called like the National Theatre for nothing. Like, it should represent also like different parts of the nation. And like then, like you said, on the stay on that very night on that stage, because you also like, I love this, your set where you challenged also this idea that, or like that you asked this question of like, is the National Theatre still transphobic? And the whole societal transphobia, but the fact that still like, okay, yeah, we were on that stage, but all the people still making decisions, all the board members, all of the, like, all of them are still cis. So then that begs the question of like, what actually happens on like a structural level? And that's a whole different conversation.
And it even comes back to the health question again, that like, if we're steeped in transphobia all around us, because our entire social structure is transphobic, not necessarily even in a violent way, I would say, all the time, but it's in a way that is just, you know, easily and effortlessly denying the fluidity and ability of gender to be different and to be creative and to be construed in different ways. So is the National Theatre still transphobic? Yes, of course it is, because our entire society is. But my point was that people shouldn't get too bent out of shape over that question. Is it trans? Yes, it is. Like, everybody should just accept that, yes, it is. And now what do we do? Like, let's make things a little more open. Let's instead of focusing on the suffering and giving these poor trans people a spot on the stage, then why don't we celebrate instead?
Yeah, definitely. And and also this idea of, again, like, yeah, how it ties to the health question, and in trans art, like that, like, I remember, like, Krista Sarasti wrote in Helsingin Sanomat in that interview of Punch Up before that show, that it was not an act of act of mercy towards trans people, but like, we were there because the show is that good, and we can build a good show, and we deserve to be on that stage. But this again challenges the notion of like trans representation being something that is just given to trans people out of, you know, the goodness of cis people's hearts, and not because it could actually like make those stories better or even different.
Yeah, it was a great night, though.
It was such a good, like, it will stay with me for the rest of my life, that night.
What do you think about, what do you think you know about community building through art?
That's a good question. I think what I've learned is to give people space, or create space for people to collide, people and ideas to collide, but like not in this sense of, not in this sense of conflict, but in this sense of like, if you think about like, atom colliders, like where you just put them in the same spot and see what like sort of sparks, what like completely new things get created. And I think, because that is also like what I feel as a producer, like when I'm producing, like my main focus is to give the artists the space to focus on the art and to focus on creating new things and giving this time and space to just let the ideas sort of ferment and bubble up. And for me, like community building through art works in the same way of like creating these spaces where people can come together. And then something might not happen on that same night or that same event, but that it's more also of these like seedlings or seeds that get planted. And like then collaborations or thoughts bubble up way later in ways that I have no idea how like that's gonna, how like, how, well, what's going to emerge.
What do you think are your responsibilities as a producer? Specifically talking about towards like queer art and trans art.
I think one of the biggest responsibilities is seeing whose voices are missing, who else could be invited, and not just invited to the room to like meet, but who could be given, who could the power be shared with even more, because I believe in sharing the power.
Yeah, because if you say like who could be given a voice, it's kind of similar to the National Theater giving us, you know.
Yeah.
But there are limits, I guess. So, like for instance, I've thought, you know, Punch Up is a show run by three white people.
Yeah.
And we do have people of color on our shows. But I think for me, it's kind of gotten to the point where if we wanted to structurally become more inclusive in that way, we would have to alter our actual working structure and have new people making decisions, because you just run into a limitation.
Yeah. And because there's the sort of curatorial power that we have. And then that is also something that can be shared, and that we also have plans to share that curatorial power. Because then it's not just being this, by our grace, you are welcome on our stage.
Yeah. What about, how do you balance a voice that needs to be heard with an artistic level that has to be achieved in order for that voice to belong in the stage?
I think, I think that this sort of intertwining of different clubs and producers and stages is so necessary and beneficial for that. Like, I remember at some point, for example, like before the pandemic, there were so many different shows happening, and we were working on a number of different shows. There was Gekkos Klubi with you, so there was Feminist Comedy Night, there was, you run Feminist Comedy Academy every now and then, there was Punch Up, there was the Attic Underground, like when that was, the Attic Underground started on the same year as Punch Up. So there was this, and then of course all these other shows that we were not like producing, but had connections to. So then if a person would, for example, send us a message of like, oh, I would like to perform, or like then, or off quite often I would go to see shows or just meet people who I would be like, oh, you have interesting brain, or like you seem to be doing something interesting. Like, if you want to perform, here's a stage. But then like there were so many like different sort of levels of stages and of audiences and of rooms. So then it was also, it was more of this guiding or giving giving tips on like, well, for this piece that you're working on, I think this room would be the best to start with. And then who knows where that will lead and where that will go. But I think like this, having various levels of and various sizes of rooms and audiences and shows and showrunners, like helped and helps so much with that. Because then, like to command, for example, to perform on a major stage or like a bigger stage, there are like some like skills that are good for you to have. To be able to just be able to perform on a stage like that, and to just perform in a way that you are felt in the back row. But then, if the only stages you have are like only sort of like these very underground shows and these very big shows, and then there's a huge gap. So then, like having all these. Sort of, and it's not a value thing, like that, like shows on bigger stages would be more valuable or better than shows like on smaller stages, but like this sort of like for the performers also, that like if performers like want to like challenge themselves or like develop certain things, then different stages and different rooms work like differently to for that.
But it's kind of weird though, like you, as a producer, yeah. You're in a, like a small local scene, at a queer scene and a trans scene, like you're kind of like a, you know, a big producer, a big, like big Hollywood name who can like, you know, a taste maker kind of thing. That must feel, are you aware of that power? Or do you feel like you have power in that way?
Yeah. And because I know people, I can make contacts between people. I can recommend people. It's a huge power of recommending. Yeah, if people sort of trust your taste and ask like, who should I book for this? And then it's always. I need to remind myself to sort of also keep updating the list in my head of like people who I recommend or like. Constantly like explore and find new people to like add to that ever-growing list of amazing performers.